This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, Nicolai Bailhart's with you for the Country Hour, broadcasting live today from the Best Wool, Best Lamb Conference, which is being held in Bendigo. This, of course, follows on from the Beef Conference, the Better Beef Conference, which was held yesterday. Now, there was a gala dinner last night for those lucky enough to attend, featuring beef and lamb. So today on the program, we'll speak with the chef, Adrian Richardson, who put that menu together. He's got some interesting tips, I should say, on how to make the best of cheap cuts from both animals, but he also raises an interesting point about marketing of meat and whether lamb could do perhaps a little bit more in that space. We'll also meet some farmers from New Zealand. They've been facing some interesting challenges over there, so we'll find out how they've been overcoming things like succession planning. But it, of course, has been a big and busy day outside Bendigo today as well. The state government's finalised its plan to try and protect the right to farm. And this comes after nearly a year of negotiation with industry groups. So that's a big one. So we'll be talking about that on the Country Hour today as well.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
As I say, though, the strong focus here in Bendigo today is all things wool and lamb. And I've got to say, it's pretty nice to be at a big gathering of industry and growers where, for the large part, people are pretty happy. The industry is looking pretty good. You don't get to say that very often. But one of the interesting questions that's being asked today is whether those good times will necessarily last, how long they might last for. Rob Herman is Managing Director of Mercado. He's been delving deep into this and joins us. Rob, thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Nicola.
So we do need to put all of this in a bit of context, and we probably don't need to spend too much time on it, but it has been a remarkable run for both wool and lamb. Maybe we'll start with wool. It is incredible.
Yes, it is incredible. And it's been coming for a while, and it's generally across the micron ranges now, although the strong crossbred people would be saying they're missing out, but otherwise everybody else is getting a taste of it. And it's lasting for a period of time where wool growers are going to get one or two goes at it already, and then, of course, what's ahead?
And we'll talk about that in a moment. But in a way, I feel like the lamb side of the game has been a little bit quieter, because it's been going quite well, but it hasn't been getting the same headlines as wool.
No, it hasn't. Well, of course, wool is what Australia rides on the sheep's back, and wool is quite well regarded. But lamb has been it's been happening for a while, and it's been a steady, strong growth. And we're seeing that growth in two areas. One is that we've got slightly increasing slaughter numbers per month per year over the year, and we've got an increasing price. And that's a really good model to explain how demand is generally stronger, because economic modelling says that, you know, when price goes up, it's as a result of lower supply, and in fact, in this case, it's not.
And people might be able to hear, probably heard that bell in a moment. Everything's okay, don't worry, they're just swapping sessions. There'll be a few people wandering around in the next few moments. So you have been looking at this idea of whether these good times will last. For wool, do you think the good times are here to stay?
Look, I think there's a couple of things in favour of wool, and wool growers will remember and know that in the past we have been blindsided. You know, we've had good times and we think they're here, and then something happens to pull the rug out from underneath our feet. But the thing in our favour at the moment is that we do have low supply, and in the short term that's a good thing. In the longer term that doesn't help us, though, because eventually demand has to contract to meet supply. You can't have unsatisfied demand sitting out there. And the other thing is that we're probably coming off a reasonably long period of low prices. Wool generally cycles, and we've seemed to have missed a cycle. So now we're in what could be termed a very strong cycle, or even a super cycle. So that'll stretch things out a bit too.
And how much smaller are the offerings getting? Do you expect them to remain small? Because the options have been pretty tight lately.
Yeah, look, they have. But that's seasonal as well, Nicolai. I guess the more concerning factor is that in the last 10 years, in the merino types, 700,000 bales has gone. You know, those sheep are gone, and they're not going to come back. So we're at a smaller clip level. It will pick up again in the spring because, you know, more people are shearing. But we're seeing now that the buyers and processors are showing genuine concern about where supply is coming from in the future, and that's something that in the short term works for price, but in the longer term doesn't come through.
So if prices are very high at the moment, Is there a potential for growers to capitalise on that? Because we've talked a little bit about the idea of forward contracting or kind of locking in prices now. It doesn't seem to be done a whole lot.
No, it doesn't, and it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting dynamics behind that. Mm. But wool and wheat, I guess, are the two commodities where people can lock in forward in agricultural production systems, whereas beef cattle and lambs, it's very difficult to lock in forward. But there's only a very small portion of wool forward sold for the next clip and the clip after, and that's something that we think farmers should be looking at. They should be looking at saying, well, we know that markets fluctuate. We may still be optimistic about the future, but perhaps we do some of our wool for next year. So perhaps we forward sell some.
And for the lamb side of things, do you think good times will last for the meat side of things?
I think it's a really optimistic story, Nikolai. And it goes down to where the markets are developing. And the markets are developing for lamb in the areas where the populations are large, so in Asia and countries just to the north of us. And it's also happening where people are looking for higher quality proteins as their incomes improve. So it's a good story, and it's likely to stay. And just on a side note, you know, one of the areas, a spin-off area, will be that the price of mutton will be at, in the future, in our view, will be historically high and closer to lamb price than ever before, because those markets that are developing, you know, the old humble mutton, the humble sheep, that product suits very well into their cooking styles.
Well, so I was about to say, so is that likely, do you think, to happen more overseas than domestically?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Mutton is 100% exported almost. And we've seen in the last year, you know, all of a sudden China suddenly becomes very interested in mutton. And what mutton does, it gives the cooks protein, it gives them a bit of flavour, and it doesn't matter how long you cook it for, you're still going to end up with some sort of texture at the end. So it ticks some boxes, which we probably won't ever appreciate in Australia, but certainly in these Asian countries, that's good.
And so one broad question that I think can work probably across both wool and lamb to finish on, do you think the good times that we're seeing in these industries at the moment will encourage more people that are in the broadacre sector to get back into sheep and wool, or do you think they'll stay where they are?
That's a really good question, and it's something I'm concerned about, to be honest, Nicolai, because at this time we should, in a normal economic model, when prices for both sheep and lamb and wool are at historically high levels, then the flock should be growing and the clip should be growing, and we don't see any evidence of that. And it's very difficult to do because the big exodus of sheep farms has been to cropping, and those farmers aren't coming back. They're not coming back. They've made their commitments. Their infrastructure's changed, and they're quite, by and large, they're quite content with what they're doing. Around the margins, they're probably saying, gee, I wish I had a few sheep now, but that's not translating into action. So that'll be the challenge. And if you're talking about sheep and lamb, I mean, even New Zealand now has a much contracted flock. And so with Australia and New Zealand, the only two major export countries of sheep and lamb meat, the supply is going to be tight. And that's going to help the market.
Okay, interesting times remain ahead. Thank you so much for your time today, Rob.
You're welcome. Thanks, Nicolai.
That is Rob Herman from Mercado. Nikolai Bailhart's with you, broadcasting from the Best Wool, Best Lamb Conference here in Bendigo this afternoon. It's 13 minutes past 12 when you are listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. Now, as I mentioned, some of the farmers and industry people here, both beef and lamb, were lucky enough to head to this gala dinner last night, which was put together by the highly regarded chef Adrian Richardson from La Luna Restaurant in Melbourne. He says that it was a bit of a challenge putting together a meal, knowing that the people who grew the animals would be at the dinner.
Well, there's a couple of things I like to think about. And for me, the pressure's on, because these guys make the lamb and the beef that I'm about to cut into little pieces and serve them. And also, they're farmers. They're men off the land, you know. To do something really fluffy and fancy is probably not going to cut it. They're going to want something a little bit more substantial, interesting, but I don't want to push it over the top. So my idea was the entree was the lamb, which we slow braised. We got some four quarter and slow braised it and made it into a little pie, which was delicious. Mm. And then, of course, the rib of beef, which is always going to be delicious, nice and slow cooked so it falls off the bone, with some lovely veggies, you know, some shiitake mushrooms and some potatoes. So it's a really nice looking dish, nice and pretty, but substantial and tasty. And I think that's what they wanted.
What kind of response did you get?
A really good response. People loved it, especially the entree, which is a bisteya. It's an Egyptian style of dish, usually done with pigeon. But what we did was slow cook the lamb, braise the shoulder so it fell apart, and put some spinach, some currants and pine nuts in it, a little bit of Danish feta, and then we wrap it in phyllo pastry, which is very light and crisp. And we put it on top of labneh, which is basically a yogurt cheese, nice and creamy, and it all works really well. But on top of the pie, we sprinkle it with some icing sugar and cinnamon, just to give it a real sort of sweetness, and then you get the savoury lamb all the way through. It's a beautiful dish.
The really hard question, do you have a favourite? Does beef or lamb clearly win in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what, for me, when it was coming to main course, was it going to be beef or lamb? It came down to a flip of a coin, you know, and heads came up, so beef won. I love both of them, and I really like cooking beef, especially if you're cooking steaks. But if you're going to slow braise, I think lamb is really good as well. I'll break down a whole body, roll it and tie it, and braise it in red wine with garlic, rosemary, a little bit of onion and carrot. I think it's a beautiful lamb. Lamb, I think, braises really well, exceptionally well.
And we have seen both meats really become quite expensive over the past couple of years. Has that made you look at different cuts and trying to maybe save a bit of money by using cheaper cuts?
Well, I've always at my restaurants bought in whole bodies or whole argies and whole bodies of lamb. I think it's a smarter way of doing it. I mean, the primal cuts, the loins and the fillet and the rump and the ribeye, they basically make up about 19%, a small portion of the body. So to make any money out of that sort of the animal, you really have to start thinking about secondary cuts. You buy them a lot cheaper, you value add them, and you sell them for a fortune on the plate. You know, lamb shanks are probably a great idea, a great example of that. Years ago, the butcher would throw in a couple of lamb shanks with every sausage you bought. Nowadays, you know, I think they're $4.50, and restaurants, unscrupulous restaurateurs, are selling them for a hell of a lot more than that. But it just goes to show that the secondary cuts work really well, and I think they require a little bit more thought, a little bit more effort, and the results are far better than just a steak slapped on the grill.
What about, I don't know if you'd even call them the third cuts, but offal and things like that. Do you use them as well, don't you?
I love offal.
Yeah.
I really enjoy cooking offal. It's something I've done a lot of. But unfortunately for the general population, they don't like it. But, you know, there's nothing like tripe that's braised with tomato and red wine, tripe alla romana, which is a dish that we do at the restaurant, you know, the livers and kidneys. I think a lot of the older Australians, the older generation, have eaten it because meat has always been expensive and they want to use every part of it. And I think for me, it's a good idea. I mean, we're raising an animal, we're slaughtering it, and we're cutting it up. We should be using every part of it, I think, you know, and using a little bit of offal. I know it's an acquired taste, but, you know, have a little taste of it. It's not as bad as you think, especially things like heart and liver. They're quite delicious, I think.
One of the interesting things that we were discussing on the program yesterday with Professor Wendy Umberger from the University of Adelaide, she's done some research into labelling of meats and looking into things like, well, you know, you used to just buy red meat and it was red meat and that was it. But now you get grass-fed, you get organic. Some of them will say that they're animal welfare friendly. Are you seeing people, are your customers asking more about where their produce comes from, but also how it's raised?
Yes. I think what we call it, the branding, or I call it the story. You know, when you pick up a tray of meat and it's from a particular producer and it's grass-fed and grown under the sunshine and fed on daisies, I think people are interested and they want to know that the animals have been looked after. And a lot of these brands are well-known. They're gourmet brands. And the expectation from the consumer is that the animals are better looked after and therefore we're going to get better meat and we're prepared to pay a little bit more for it. And I think that's a great thing. As far as my customers go. A lot of people just come in and have a great steak or a great piece of meat and walk out the door. Some people, then there's a lot of them that want to know what we do. And we dry age all of our meat in the cool room, so I'll take people out the back. I talk to them about my producers. I do know quite a lot of the producers that supply me with meat and other produce. And I think it's a great thing. I think there's a lot of people that want to know about that. And when I can tell a story, it's almost like selling it. You know, you're coming to my restaurant and I'm not just buying it in. I'm actually talking about the potato farmer that I've been on the phone to that day, you know, telling me to change potatoes because they're going out of season. I think the story is very important. And I think it helps with the dining experience. I think we eat a lot with our brains, and if our brain is convinced that that meat is going to be really good, it's well looked after, it's going to taste a lot better as well.
And it does seem to happen a lot in beef, particularly when you're looking at red meats, but it doesn't happen quite so much in lamb, you mentioned. It's kind of an interesting idea.
Oh, you're stirring the pot here. Beef producers, I think, the Angus community, they've been really good at marketing. With lamb, and my understanding, I was educated last night by the lamb people. Lamb seems to be a mixture of crossbreeds. They do a lot of crossbreeding. Composite, I think, is the word they used. And so they basically want everyone to buy lamb, and they want to just all lamb should be good. That's great, and I understand what they're doing, but it's also, for someone like myself, I would like to be able to say that Farmer Joe is growing this particular Dorper sheep, and it's really good for marbling, and it's had a great life, and the sheep's got an interesting story. I think when I can talk about those sorts of things to my customers, it helps with the dining and the eating experience. Whether that sort of thing can translate onto the supermarket shelf, where a lot of meat goes, or onto the butcher's trays, I think yes. I think there's an opportunity for that. Whether the lamb industry want to go that way is up to them. But for me, if I can talk about my Angus or my Hereford steer that's been looked after, slaughtered, and then dry aged, and that's what you've got, it's come from this farmer, I think that's a great thing. It doesn't happen as much with lamb. It's a lot harder to come by, but I think it's possible.
Because I guess the challenge there, or the counterpoint, could be, if it's extra work, then some producers will think, well, is it worth it? Is it actually worth the financial reward? So do you see if there's a story attached that people are willing to pay a bit more?
Yes. I will pay more for better quality meat. I will pay more for a better story. I will pay more for that extra marbling in lamb. I will pay for that saltbush lamb. I'll pay for that particular breed. I will pay for that story, because if I'm not just buying lamb that's coming off the rail, I'm just buying something special. And that's what I can talk about, because it happens quite a lot when you go to a restaurant, the waiters will say, hey, we've got this beautiful lamb, it's come from this area. They're selling it. And if you give them something to sell, a story to sell it, they'll put a lot more into it, and you're more likely to sell it. I'm more likely to get an extra $1 or $2 per plate and sell a bottle of wine with it. That's how I make a living.
That's very interesting thoughts, isn't it? Whether or not you can make more money out of lamb if you market it a little bit differently. That's the chef, Adrian Richardson, from La Luna Restaurant. He's based in Melbourne and put together the menu for dinner here last night. It is 22 past 12 here on the Country Hour. My name's Nikolai Bailharts, broadcasting today from the Best Wool, Best Lamb Conference, which is underway in Bendigo today. So we have had a little bit of a snapshot of how the industry is travelling here in Australia. And as we've heard, across both wool and lamb meat, there's some pretty good times at the moment, but we'll find out now if that's being felt a little bit further afield and hear the story of a couple of very interesting farmers, Gundy and Lisa Anderson from Borgaroy Station in New Zealand. They've been speaking here today, telling us really their farming story, and they join us. Guys, thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no worries.
So we need to put a little bit of a context to you guys. Tell us about where your farm is and what you run there.
We're farming down the central South Island of New Zealand, and we're running an all merino ewe flock, and then a few cows, beef cows as well, Hereford cattle, and producing wool and lamb.
And we've just heard that earlier in the program that things are looking incredibly good price-wise for wool and lamb here in Australia. Is it necessarily the same thing in New Zealand?
Yeah, pretty much, by the sounds of it. I think everything's all pretty positive at the moment, as well as low interest rates. So, yeah, we're not complaining too much.
Is it an industry that's in flux? People kind of moving in or out of merino particularly, or is it kind of pretty stable?
Yeah, there's actually been a reasonable swing to half-bred ewes, okay, and also some crossbred ewes, just with the lack of production they're getting out of merinos. So there has been a trend getting out of them. But I'd like to think if the breed's turning around, and now that the wool price is lifting up as well, that there probably will be a drift back, where people try and get back to that. It's human nature, chasing markets, really. But we decided the more people are getting out of them, the more we'd stick with them, because we've got a fair bit of faith in the breed and the potential of the breed, and we'd just get concentrating on that rather than change out.
So tell us, I want to know more about the story of your farm and how it really became your farm, in a sense. It's been in the family for a long time, but I gather there was a somewhat of a challenge in how it became yours.
Yeah, I guess like anyone facing farm succession, I'm fourth generation there. My great grandfather took up the lease in 1919, and so I had a couple of sisters and parents to settle off the property, which, whatever way you slice it up, it requires capital, and then that obviously means a mortgage or taking on a mortgage, and quite a sizable challenge. The other thing that's really real and really not talked about, and it's extremely hard to talk about, is the emotion involved, because it's been as my sister's home for that time, and for them to leave it or feel like it's been lost is not so good. But all we can do is make them feel very welcome and to be back there again. And for the parents who worked really hard on it, made it their home, their business, they're really proud of it, it's been their life's work, for them to step aside and let you take over is really tough. So I think, the bigger factor is probably the human side of it, and the emotion side of it is by far larger than the financial side, and so the finances, the nuts and bolts, but it's pretty tough, and because it's so personal, it's not talked about a lot, really.
And it's hard to talk about.
But it's extremely real, because in one scenario, you could have the best flock in the country and all that sort of thing, and it all flies to bits. You end up not talking to a family for the rest of your life, and with a farm that's been sold. So in the worst case scenario, which is awful, and it defeats the purpose. It makes you ask the question, why are you even here? What are you doing? Everything else sort of pales into insignificance. But if that bit's not right, and it is extremely hard to get right with the capital land prices being higher and higher, and especially
to the business model.
And Lisa, I gather too, that was one of the questions that you did look at, was, do we actually want to do this? Do we want to take on the farm? Because sounds basic, but it's an important question.
Well, we were looking at committing ourselves to doing this, and didn't know, did we want to bear the consequences? And on the other side, flip side, Gundy mentioned he's fourth generation and our children are fifth generation. There's quite an element of pressure that's put on you to not be the generation. If you're going to do it, you're not going to be the generation that stuff it up and potentially end up having to sell, because whether or not it's your fault or the legacy issues that you've inherited, you don't want to be the generation to muck it up. So, and there is, I don't know about here in Australia, but certainly where we are, there's an element of stigma attached to you, the generation that sold the family farm. So, rightly or wrongly, that's how we felt.
Yeah. So, how did you work your way through and around those emotional hurdles? Because I don't know if there's a textbook to kind of help you through that.
That was not a nice time.
There's not a textbook, and it is pretty tough. Myself, personally, I try and talk, and probably a bit much at times, but I just talk, get it out there, what you're feeling, and us fellas don't like talking about that, but and try and get family to talk about that as well. It's just, what's the real problem? Because as in a lot of cases, say you have a spat with your spouse, it's not the dirty dishes in the sink that really are annoying you at the time. It's actually what you did 5 days ago was really really the problem. And once you tease it out and keep at it, then you find what the kernel of the problem is. And sometimes there isn't an easy way. That's it. Just sometimes it's not an easy way. It's not going to be that pleasant, and it is going to be really tough.
And it is confronting. I remember our lawyer, the family lawyer, pointing out, because I talk a lot of things personally, and he pointed out, he said, this isn't you, Lisa. It was whoever was going to marry him was going to be this person. And stepping into, like you said, someone else's family home and and not just the house, but where they grow up. And there's an element of resentment, but you've got to realise it's not meant personally. It's just that they're feeling threatened, and you almost need to do a complete 180 and empathise with their situation and make them feel like they're welcome to come back.
I think the one thing we owe, and we both felt extremely strongly about this too, is that we've been given the opportunity, so we need to give it 110, really give it 110, because we've had the privilege of carrying on there. So not just to sit back sort of fat and happy or whatever and think that it's okay, not that we could in our situation anyway, but you owe it to give it 110%. So then if someone, at least that makes the pill a wee bit easier to swallow, because you're watching this person who isn't taking up the reins or whatever, that they are genuinely giving it a real effort to do the best possible job and look after the place.
And I gather that's where another interesting question that you ask yourselves came in: would we employ ourselves? Which is a hard question.
Yeah. and quite confronting, actually, because you are seriously looking at where you're lacking. And and we recognised there were a few areas, and one of them was our business management. And but what it meant was it put us in the position of realising we needed to find experts in the areas that we weren't strong in to educate us and hold our hand through this growth period. And we weren't scared to go and ask. And we actually had a really, he's now a good friend of ours, but one of our vet consultant, make the comment to us that like, they commit their lifetimes to researching in these areas, and their biggest thrill is actually helping the likes of us. So, and especially when we actually listen to what they have to offer and then implement it, and that's where we're fulfilling their career outcomes as well. So actually it's a real win-win, which is really nice, and we've made some lifelong friends with these guys that they probably have no idea how much they've helped us.
So we're very rapidly running out of time, but maybe just to wrap up, what's your key advice for people if they are kind of going down this path or thinking they're going to have to go down this path? What do you think people need to be having their minds?
Well, that number one to me is give it 110%, really try hard. Be really honest with yourself, not in a harsh way. Be kind to yourself, but be really honest. And like people say, oh, I'm no good at this. It's okay. How can you get good at it? Because if you've got a brain and physically able and things, you can get good at it if it's something physical. So you can actually change. But just look in the mirror, be honest, and enjoy it as well. You know, remember to laugh, and you wanted to be here. If you don't really want to be there, then don't be there. Don't just sit back and oh, woe is me, and look what life's doing to me. Front foot it.
Well, guys, I'd like to thank you for being so honest. I know it's not the easiest thing to talk about, and we don't hear it that much, so it's been a really refreshing and really interesting conversation. So thank you for being so honest with us all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. That's Gundy and Lisa Anderson from Bogroy Station in New Zealand. It is 29 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. That doesn't mean it's time to get the latest in local news headlines. And once again, it's a good afternoon to Pete Lennigan here on site at Best Wool, Best Lamb.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Authorities have seized animal traps, computers and a four-wheel drive as part of an investigation into the suspected poisoning of 136 wedge-tailed eagles in East Gippsland. The eagles were found killed along with other bird species last month. No charges have been laid. The Victorian Government has finalised its plan to protect what's been dubbed the right to farm after nearly a year of negotiations with industry groups. The reforms introduce new land use definitions and changes to planning laws for animal industries across Victoria. The Victorian Farmers Federation is continuing to lobby for lower rural rates as councils in the Wimmera Mallee finalise their budgets for the coming financial year. The VFF has singled out the Northern Grampian Shire for praise after councillors rejected a proposal for a 25% increase to rural rates. The Bacchus Marsh Hospital, at the centre of a potentially avoidable cluster of perinatal deaths, has had to restrict its services because of an acute staff shortage. An internal email has revealed 10 surgical staff have left since the start of the year, forcing the temporary closure of a procedure area. The Jerriwarra Health Service has unveiled its new $1.6 million obstetrics unit today. And the Albury and Wodonga councils have backed calls from Amnesty International for the federal government to expand and improve a program that allows the private sponsorship of refugees. The government currently has a community support program which allows refugee sponsorship. For more stories, you can visit our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thank you very much, Pete Lennigan, live on site here at Best Wool, Best Lamb. And you are listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. Still plenty to come. Pete mentioned those finalisations of the state government's plans on right to farm legislation. It's been something that's been discussed for a long time here in Victoria, so I'll find out what that proposal is in a little bit more detail. But first, let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Tom Delamotte is on duty. And Tom, while it's a little bit chilly here in Bendigo, it's really not too bad, all things considered.
That's right. Yeah, although it doesn't look like it's going to heat up too much further with the cloud cover that's around at the moment. So temperatures through sort of, western part of the northern country and also up into the eastern parts of the Mallee there, only getting up to around 10 or 11 degrees today. And there is some light rain falling as well up towards the Murray, particularly around the Swan Hill area. They've had 3 millimetres since 9 a.m. After picking up 1.4 to 9 a.m. So just some steady light rain falling through that eastern part of the Mallee and down into the far west of the northern country as well. Through the rest of the state, we did start off the day with quite extensive fog through the southwest and central districts. That is starting to ease off now. And otherwise, it's largely sort of a mostly sunny day through the northeast and partly cloudy elsewhere.
Okay, and are those trends set to continue over the next few days?
Yeah, we are going to see a continuation of that cloud streaming down from New South Wales into tomorrow. So that cloud band just very slowly moves eastwards with the rainfall associated with it moving eastwards sort of along the Murray. So I think sort of really just around where it's falling at the moment through till midnight, and then starts to move tomorrow. So through the northern country and also into the northeast, and eventually parts of East Gippsland, we'll see some patchy light rain through tomorrow. Generally, I think the falls are going to be less than 5 millimetres, and the most likely areas to see falls up that higher, really the areas bordering New South Wales along the Murray, and also the far east part of Gippsland around Mallacoota or so. Elsewhere across the state, does look like we're going to see another frosty start to the day through the southwest and also central parts tomorrow, and potentially some fairly widespread fog once again through western and central parts of Victoria, with the more, I guess, the clearer skies as the cloud does tend to move east during tomorrow. And then that cloud moves away. We really see it contract away from the state by Thursday evening. And we're really just left with a light shower to about the northeast ranges, which continues into Friday morning. And that's ahead of the next cold front, which is going to move up. So that's the cold front, which is crossing southwest WA at the moment. It's going to move through and start to push through Victoria during Friday morning. But mostly during the afternoon, we'll see that the impacts move across Victoria. So showers developing across the western parts of the state late morning on Friday, and then pushing into the central and parts of the eastern districts as well as we move into the afternoon and evening on Friday. Looks like the best falls are going to be about the northeast ranges and also the southwest coast, where we could see some falls around the, I guess, 3 to 8 millimetre range. But elsewhere, we're generally looking at falls less than 3 millimetres or so. And it does look like the only area which we'll miss out on Friday will be East Gippsland and parts of West Gippsland, just in the lee of the ranges there, just to the southern side of the ranges. Also, we could see a thunderstorm or two just about the far southwest as we move into Friday afternoon. And then on Saturday, we continue to see some showers about southern and mountain districts in the westerly flow behind the front. Does look like a bit of cold air moves up behind it, so the snow level drops down to around 1,000 metres or so during Saturday. So it does look like a little bit of a top-up for the alpine resorts. Anyone heading up to the snow this weekend, a little bit of snow around on Saturday, maybe 5 or 10 centimetres as that front moves through. But elsewhere, we're just going to see falls less than 5 millimetres, increasing up to around 10 millimetres about the exposed southwest coast and also parts of the northeast ranges for Saturday. But the shower activity does contract back to just the exposed coast during Saturday night and then continues about those areas during Sunday before clearing during Monday. And that's as the next high pressure system starts to move over northeastern parts of Victoria. So it does look like it's going to be a dry start to next week with that high sitting to the northeast of Victoria Monday through to Wednesday. So with that dry weather and also some sunny conditions developing, we're going to have the clear skies. So a bit of a return to some frost mornings in the early part of next week, but does look like the days will be sunny and dry. Probably the next chance of rain looks to be towards the end of next week as that high starts to break down a little bit with a front or two starting to push in from the west. So best chance of rain for much of the state on Friday. It does contract southwards during Saturday and Sunday, and it looks like a dry start to next week, Nikolai.
Okay, thank you so much, Tom.
No worries.
Tom Delamont on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. You are listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria. It's at 21 minutes to one. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, the state government has now finalised its plan to try and protect the right to farm after nearly a year of negotiations with industry groups. The reforms introduce new land use definitions and changes to planning laws for animal industries right across Victoria. As Jess Davis reports, the planned reforms were initially met with backlash from small-scale producers.
It's gone from a proposal that was so wrong-headed that we were, you know, we were furious, we organised, we ran a major campaign to get their attention on the problems.
Tammy Jonas is the president of the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance and a small-scale pig producer from central Victoria.
Instead of acknowledging the low risk of small-scale pastured livestock systems, they were going to cement the problem into the planning scheme with a new one that still treated us the same as if we were in shed.
In September last year, the Victorian government announced its plan to end the right to farm controversy that was gripping local government. It was sparked by a number of high-profile cases in 2015, including well-known Wagyu beef producer David Blackmore. Mr. Blackmore quit his property and moved interstate after complaints from neighbours saw his farm reclassified as intensive agriculture. Victoria's Minister for Agriculture, Jala Pulford.
New definitions have been developed for grazing animal production. And if we cast our minds back to 2015 when we started on this journey, lots of people were caught up in a very, very black and white definition of intensive.
The reforms will change the definition of intensive animal production. At the moment, animal industries need a planning permit if more than half of an animal's food is brought in from outside its enclosure. From September this year, animals that graze on pasture on a daily basis will fall under a new category, grazing animal production, and will not require a permit. But it was the proposed reforms around small-scale pig and poultry farms that sparked backlash last year.
On the one hand, we had the larger, more established pig and poultry farms saying everyone must have a permit and everyone must, you know, abide by the same very high standards. And on the other hand, we had some of the smaller producers saying, well, our risk profile is completely different, and so we need, you know, we think we don't need a permit at all. And so where we've landed is a streamlined permit system where we recognise the differences between those two, but recognise that it's appropriate for all pig and poultry operations to have a permit, but for some the permit will be, you know, as they know it. For others it'll be much simpler and easier, recognising that the risk is different.
Tammy Jonas says under the old plan, small-scale producers wouldn't have been able to afford a permit.
And the figures that we were quoted were like $20,000 to $50,000 to do your planning permit for a tiny system. That is way too much money for us, you know, to spend on a permit. So this streamlined system that we've come up with the government means we won't be sent to the referral agencies and there won't be a third-party notice and review period. So your neighbours can't object to the application itself because, again, the assumption here is that we're very small, we're very low density and we're highly mobile.
Ms Jonas says it took a lot of negotiating to get to the reforms announced today.
We didn't think we should have to have permits in the beginning because we considered ourselves like grazing animals, and we had to compromise and we've accepted that compromise. So I think the big end of town should be happy. We all have to have permits. We have to meet certain guidelines. The community can have an enormous amount of confidence that we are following through on our intentions to grow animals well and treat the land well, because we're required to meet these fairly prescriptive guidelines.
Jala Pulford says it's taken a little longer than she hoped, but all parties seem to be happy with the final product.
There's now a bit of a parliamentary process that won't take too long, but I've approved the new rules. The planning minister has approved the new rules. They sit before the Victorian Parliament for a number of sitting weeks so that the Parliament can disallow them. That's a power the Parliament has under the planning legislation. But all things being equal, these new rules will be in place in September.
And there's still some concern that this reform doesn't address things like urban encroachment on farming and actually protecting farmland. Is there anything in the pipeline for the future that would go to that length to protect farmers close to urban areas?
Well, back in 2015, when we had just an outbreak of disputes between farmers and community and, you know, people who were in trouble for not having permits, but they didn't know they needed permits. Like, the whole thing was just a bit of a mess, really. We did contemplate whether or not we would tackle all farm-related planning issues, and ultimately decided that this was the priority, this was the focus, this was where we had a reasonably pressing set of problems that we needed to put our minds to. So now that this is done, this very big part of those reforms, we will be able to turn our minds to some of those issues. But it was actually a really conscious decision to not bite off every possible problem that has the word farm and the word planning in it and try and tackle it all at once.
That's Victoria's Agriculture Minister Jala Bulford ending that report from Jess Davis. 12:45 here on the Country Hour. Let's talk Banking Royal Commission now. The focus is on rural issues this week. ANZ's Head of Lending Services, Benjamin Steinberg, has admitted to the Banking Royal Commission that ANZ did not act ethically to some farms that it foreclosed on after it acquired Landmark in 2009. Benjamin Steinberg was quizzed about ANZ's high-profile foreclosure on Queensland farmer Charlie Phillip and a Victorian grain farmer as well, Arthur Cheeseman. He admitted the ANZ could have handled the farm foreclosures better.
Well, today we would take a more empathetic approach to the needs of our customer. As you've read in my statement, we've now established a specialist agri team that yes. That deals with agricultural customers. We're guided by what's called our lending services purpose, which guides the way we should respond in these types of situations. And we would more likely look at an option that would, if possible, result in some retention of home ownership.
I just wonder why it is that you hesitate to give your view about community standards and expectations at that time, while at the same time you acknowledge that today you should act differently. What's changed in the meantime?
Well, I think there has been a change in the way that the community expects banks to behave more generally. I think that that's been driven by a number of different factors. And banks are responding to that, and in particular the parts of the bank that do the work that I do, which is the restructuring and the recovery area, are constantly reassessing the way we do things as a result of what we see to be a change in communities' attitudes towards what we should do.
You see, there's a difference between community pressure. I want you to grapple with the question of standards. What was the right thing to do at the time of these events?
The right thing to do at the time of these events would have been to structure a different arrangement with the Cheesemans, one that would have potentially given them an opportunity to retain some form of home ownership as well as retaining some way of earning an income. And that could be achieved in a number of different ways, potentially, but I think that would have been the right way to approach it.
That is ANZ's Head of Lending Services, Benjamin Steinberg, at the Banking Royal Commission. Well, Wimmera grain grower Arthur Cheeseman was a former customer of ANZ. He made a submission to the Commission, which was cited earlier this morning. He said the confession by ANZ that it did not act ethically in some cases will change very little for farmers who have been foreclosed on.
Oh, definitely too little too late. Like, we could have traded on because we had all our machinery and everything paid for, and we could have gone on in the contractual business and stayed in our houses and eventually traded out of it.
And I understand in your submission to the inquiry, you said you had 2.5 weeks to sell your properties. Is that right?
That's right.
How much pressure did that put you under?
Oh, well, imagine it. Yeah, you can't imagine it. And the other thing is, of course, the agents then, that's the first thing they ask is how much you owe. Well, that's all we're going to get.
In terms of ANZ's acknowledgement now that it would do things differently, how does that make you feel?
Terrific, doesn't it? Yeah, that does a lot of bloody good, doesn't it? What are they going to do about it?
That is Wimmera grain grower Arthur Cheeseman speaking there with our reporter Marty McCarthy. It's 11 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, agriculture ministers will now determine how cattle markets operate across the country. This news comes after the beef and cattle industry failed to implement 15 recommendations which were made by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Our reporter Cara Jeffrey spoke with ACCC Commissioner Mick Keogh, who says price reporting, carcass grading and sale yard operations will all be brought to the table at the upcoming Agriculture Ministers Forum, known as AgMin.
The beef cattle industry is a very diverse industry. A producer producing for the live export market in Northern Australia compared to a producer consigning cattle direct to the works for a processor in the central Australian regions to southern producers producing either for export or domestic markets. There's a lot of differences, and I think that complicates matters because you can't just pass one rule that would resolve the issues in all those various sectors. So, the beef industry is quite a diverse industry and quite a large industry with a lot of participants. And a lot of participants of very different scales, ranging from, you know, the biggest companies in Australia, in Australian agriculture, down to very small producers with just a few cattle. So getting it right for all those is certainly a challenge, and I think the beef industry in particular has that diversity challenge that makes it difficult to make progress.
Mr Keogh says it's disappointing the cattle and beef industry didn't take on board the ACCC recommendations.
Well, I think it is unfortunate. I think it's always more preferable for an industry to self-regulate, to work out things. And we certainly see that in a whole range of other similar industries, the real estate industry, accountants, lawyers, all those professional organisations put in place systems to make sure that they can regulate their own industry. And I think it's just unfortunate that particularly in relation to the livestock agents industry, that change hasn't been able to be made, because it would allow the industry itself to address a lot of these rather than have clumsy regulations handed down from government that add cost and get in everyone's road.
He hopes the AgMin Forum will result in change for the industry.
I suspect the Ag Ministers will consult with their industries, look at the progress that's been made and make their decisions from there, and certainly the ACCC doesn't make recommendations or legislation. That's up to government. So all we can do is say, well, these are our findings. This is what we think would solve the problem, and it will be then up to the ministers to take it from there.
New South Wales Farmers Association President Derek Scone is also hopeful the ACCC's recommendations will be implemented at a higher level.
I think AgMin is probably the spot where it has to land now, where everyone else has been ducking for cover. Farmers hate red tape, but unfortunately in this case perhaps we need just a little bit more red tape to ensure that everything is kosher.
At a grassroots level, cattle producers have welcomed news that agriculture ministers will be addressing issues plaguing their industry. Northern Victoria cattleman Colin Rapsey.
We don't need pats on the back, we need laws. Laws to make things happen.
Are you feeling confident that anything will come from that ag ministers meeting?
They'll talk about it, but probably not a lot will come from it. But the agriculture ministers need to follow the ACCC recommendations, and if they don't make it law, they may as well not have had the meeting.
And is it worrying that ag ministers could implement it rather than the cattle industry, who have skin in the game?
It is worrying, but on the other hand, the ministers are the ones with the power. They're the ones that make the laws, and if it's not law in the meat industry, you may as well not get involved in it.
Cattle producer Clyde Dunn hopes the AgMin Forum will also look at where levy dollars are being spent.
We producers don't get control of that $60 million that goes into the levies every year. My belief is that the money is being spent in many respects for sales, and that's fine. The beef and the meat needs to be sold. But that is really helping the processors. Because our prices aren't going up, we're paying for them to to improve their lot, yet our lot has not been improved.
That's Mudgee-Gonga cattle producer Clyde Dunn speaking there with Cara Jeffrey. That, of course, means it's time to head off to the livestock markets. Plenty to get through on a busy Wednesday, starting at Leongatha with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nikolai. There were 100 more at 1340, with the usual buying group operating in a dearer market in places. Quality was wintry, with a limited prime selection and cows making half the sale. Trade heifers lifted 7 cents. Grain steers and bullocks sold firm to a few cents easier. Heavy heifers gained 25. Friesian steers lifted 15. There was another local cow order. Lightweights eased 15, while the medium and heavyweight cows improved 3 to 6 cents, with processors loading heavyweights for an estimated 386 to 445 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Grown steers sold from 275 to 308, bullocks 280 to 318, heavy heifers 227 to 276, heavy Friesian steers 211 to 256, crossbreds 225 to 288. Most light and medium weight cows 131 to 190, heavyweights 171 to 229, the better shaped heavy bulls 219 to 244. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Now let's head off to Warrnambool and Eric Australian.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Cattle quality was again mixed, ranging from mostly poor to plain, with only a moderate selection of average to good quality in each category offered in the overall slightly reduced size yarding of 614 head here at Warrnambool. Prices from the current following of buyers were similar to last week, except cows, which nearly all sold 5 to 15 cents dearer. Of the poor quality one-score young and grown cattle, odd sales were cheaper. The better finished C2 and C3 yearlings sold between 245 and 287 cents, with plain of 1 and 2 score C&D muscled 180 to 230. The odd few C3 grown steers made 267 to 275 cents, most C2s 230 to 250. The C2 and C3 grown heifers made 220 to 278 cents and varied from plain to quite good condition. Poor quality E1 cows started at 110 cents, but most sold between 138 and 158. The D1 grade 171 to 194, and D2 cows were from 180 to a top of 212 cents. Been Eric Australian reporting from Warrnambool.
Thanks, Eric. And now to Wodonga and Leanne
Good
Dax.
Afternoon, agents. Yarded only 299 cows and 25 bulls in a better quality offering than the previous sale. All buyers attended and competition strengthened considerably over all classes, with prices rising 8 to 15 cents. Heavy cows, 205 to 228, averaging 215 cents. Middle run, 166 to 190. Planter types, very few here, 126 to 146. Dairy cows made from 150 to 190. And bulls slipped back 6 cents, 180 to 215. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Now to Hamilton and Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers were similar at 6,648 and sheep supply came back to 2,911 at Hamilton. Colleagues from average to good with some well-covered trayway lambs. Regular buyers attended operated in a stronger market. Most sales are good quality medium-weight lambs, $5 to $10 higher. Heavy lambs were more finished with $10 to $20 zero, and light lambs sold firm to unchanged. Light two-score lambs were $81 to $118. Light trayweight sold $115 to $139, averaging 690 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Medium trayweight two- and three-scores sold from $130 to $154, averaging 705 cents. Heavier trayweight draft made from $165 to $189, averaging 730 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy 3 and 4 score lambs sold $175 to the market top of $211, selling between $705 and $720 a kilogram carcass weight. 2,911 sheep, which covered all weights and grades, were priced with the light sheep $3 to $6, with the medium heavy mutton $10 to $20 zero. Lightweight 1 and 2 score sheep sold from $78 to $104, averaging 500 cents. Medium 2 and 3 score sold from $90 to $133, averaging 525 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy crossbred ewes sold from $140 to $196, averaging 530 cents.
Thanks very much, Tim. And now to Horsham and Graham Palmer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply increased by nearly 2,000 heads to 6,819 at Horsham this week. Quality was mostly good, with the trade weight and heavy lambs well supplied. New buying group attended and operated in a firm dairy market, with a quality lamb selling the $5 it up on last week. Heavy lamb sold at $227 and the heavier trade weight sold from $170 to $190, average around 730 cents. Merino lamb sold from $109 to $165. Peters and Queensland Stockers were reserved with their purchases, but did pay to $113.50 for lambs. It was 2,109 sheep yarder with all weights on offer. Sheep again sold strong demand, selling confirmed at $10 head up in places. Merino ewes reached $191, and crossbred ewes sold to $172. Trade weight three score lambs sold from $138 to $152, to average around $730. Heavier trade weight sold from $170 to $190. The export three and four score lambs sold from $186 to $222, and they averaged $7.20. Extra heavy export lambs made from $219.50 to $227. Medium weight sheep sold from $112 to $147, with merino mutton averaging around $545. Heavy rams are made to $115, and grain prime portion for NLA.
Thanks, Graham. Now let's find out what's coming up on Statewide Drive. Afternoon, Nicole Trevastic.
G'day. Police and wildlife officers have executed search warrants at four properties around Orbost as part of their investigation into the poisoning of 136 wedge-tail eagles. We're going to have a look at the new right-to-farm laws, and I'd love to know what is the worst movie of all time. There is a festival on in Castlemaine showing Curse of the Cat People.
Oh, that sounds good, bad. That and plenty more on Statewide Drive with Nicole Trevastic from 3 o'clock this afternoon here on ABC Radio Victoria.